Hello, welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Thursday, December 1st. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the paper today, Congress acts to avert rail strike set for next week. This is an AP story. The U.S. House moved urgently Wednesday to head off the looming nationwide rail strike, passing a bill that would bind companies and workers to a proposed settlement that was reached in September, but rejected by some of the 12 unions involved. The measure passed by a vote of 290 to 137 and now heads to the Senate. If approved there, it will be signed by President Joe Biden, who urged the Senate to act swiftly. Without the certainty of a final vote to avoid a shutdown this week, railroads will begin to halt the movement of critical materials like chemicals to clean our drinking water as soon as this weekend, Biden said. Let me say that again. Without action this week, disruptions to our auto supply chains, our ability to move food to tables, and our ability to remove hazardous waste from gasoline refineries will begin. Business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Farm Bureau Federation, have warned that halting rail service would cause a devastating $2 billion per day hit to the economy. The bill would impose a compromise labor agreement brokered by the Biden administration that was ultimately voted down by four of the 12 unions, representing roughly 115,000 employees at large freight railroads. The unions have threatened to strike if an agreement can't be reached before a December 9 deadline. Lawmakers from both parties expressed reservations about overriding the negotiations, and the intervention was particularly difficult for Democratic lawmakers, who have traditionally sought to align themselves with the politically powerful labor unions that have criticized Biden's move to intervene in the contract dispute and block a strike. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded to that concern by adding a second vote Wednesday that would add 7 days of paid sick leave per year for rail workers covered under the agreement. However, it will take effect only if the Senate goes back and passes both measures. The House passed the sick leave measure as well, but by a much narrower margin, 221 to 207, as Republicans overwhelmingly opposed it, indicating that prospects for passage of the add-on are slim in the evenly divided Senate. Business groups and the Association of American Railroads Trade Association praised the House vote to block the strike, but urged senators to resist adding the sick time. Unless Congress wants to become the de facto end game for future negotiations, any effort to put its thumb on the bargaining scale to artificially advantage either party or otherwise obstruct a swift resolution would be wholly irresponsible, said Ian Jeffries, head of the Trade Association. The call for more paid sick leave was a major sticking point in the talks, along with other quality of life concerns. The railroads say the unions have agreed in negotiations to forego paid sick time in favor of higher wages and strong short-term disability benefits. Jeffries said railroads would consider adding paid sick time in the future, but said that change should wait for a new round of negotiations. The unions maintain railroads can easily afford it at a time when they are recording record profits. Several of the big railroads involved in these contract talks reported more than $1 billion in profit in the third quarter. Quite frankly, the fact that paid leave is not part of the final agreement between railroads and labor is, in my opinion, obscene, said Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat, Massachusetts. It should be there, and I hope it will be there in the end process. Most rail workers don't receive any paid sick time, but they do have short-term disability benefits that kick in after as little as 4 days and can replace some of their income for a year or more. Rail workers also receive vacation and personal leave days, but they say those are difficult to use for illnesses as they typically must be approved far in advance. Republicans voiced support for the measure to block the strike, but criticized the Biden administration for turning to Congress to step in to fix the mess. They've retreated in failure, and they kicked this problem to Congress for us to decide, said Representative Sam Graves, Republican, Missouri. Republicans criticized Pelosi's decision to add the sick leave bill to the mix. They said the Biden administration's own special board of arbitrators recommended higher wages to compensate the unions for not including sick time in its recommendations. The compromise agreement that was supported by the railroads and the majority of the unions provides for 24% raises and $5,000 in bonuses retroactive to 2020, along with one additional paid leave day. The raises would be the biggest rail workers have received in more than four decades. Workers would have to pay a larger share of their health insurance costs, but their premiums would be capped at 15% of the total cost of the insurance plan. The agreement did not resolve workers' concerns about schedules that make it hard to take a day off and the lack of more paid sick time. Also on the front page today, Johnson boosts wages for child care workers. This story by Isabella Zaluska. Amid a statewide child care crisis, a collaboration between Johnson County, Iowa City, and businesses will increase wages for eligible child care workers by $2 per hour. The wage enhancement program is intended to boost pay without raising the cost for families. The program's other goals are attracting and retaining child care workers and promotion of the profession. The program will be funded by $1.5 million in pandemic relief dollars from the two local governments, along with additional investment from area businesses. Experts previously told the Gazette that businesses need to get involved to help solve the child care crisis, an issue that was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Once businesses invest in child care, they stick with it because they see the benefits, such as bringing people back into the workforce. Johnson County Supervisor Pat Hyden said it is a significant to be discussing this program, and the pandemic relief dollars will move the needle dramatically. Supervisor Lisa Green Douglas agreed, calling the program a game changer. "We see this as a real opportunity to have an impact on our community," Lynette Jacoby, the county's social services director, told the Board of Supervisors Wednesday. A Johnson County family earning the median income with an infant in child care spends 14% of its income on child care, according to data presented by Jacoby. Affordable child care is classified as 7% of a family's income. Johnson County has some of the highest costs for child care in the state. A family with two children pays an average of $2,008 every month, or $24,096 per year, on child care in the county. Affordable, quality child care is out of reach for many households in Johnson County, Jacoby said. The county contacted all 52 licensed centers to ask questions about capacity, filled slots, wait lists, and staff impact, among other questions. A total of 42 centers responded. The centers surveyed have a total wait list of 1,874 children. Five of the programs have lists of 100 or more. The 42 centers, which do not include in-home providers, have a licensed capacity of 4,254. There are currently 2,949 filled slots, but the empty slots available can't be filled due to staffing shortages, said Lori Nash, the county's youth and family service manager. There are 102 full-time staff openings, along with 66 part-time openings. Experts previously told the Gazette the child care industry has struggled to remain competitive, especially with other businesses upping their wages and offering benefits. The average child care worker in Johnson County is paid $11.16 per hour, which is the lowest for any tracked professional. "Even though we have empty slots and kids on waiting lists, we can't fill those slots because we don't have the staff to do it," Nash said. The wage enhancement program will be administered by Johnson County Social Services. The wage supplement will be paid in a lump sum to providers, which will then pay the eligible employees. To be eligible for the wage enhancement program, child care centers must be licensed and serve children age 5 or younger. The hourly minimum wage paid to workers must be at least the county's recommended minimum wage of $11.56 per hour. The centers must participate in the state's quality rating scale or maintain accreditation from the National Association of the education of young people. Centers also must maintain a child care assistance cap of at least 20%, which refers to the portion of a center's capacity that's reserved for families who receive state assistance. Funding will be prioritized to centers that aren't already subsidized through another federal or state means, Jacoby said. Once centers qualify, the child care professionals within the center must consistently work at least 32 hours a week and be a year-round employee. The employee must work with children 5 or younger, earn less than $23 per hour, and work directly with children. This does not include statewide preschool teachers. We think overall with the program, if an individual is working 35 hours per week, the $2 per hour boost would increase their wage to just over $4,000 annually. Johnson County is investing $250,000 per year for 3 years to fund the program. Iowa City agreed to match up to $250,000 a year, Jacoby said. Between the two local governments, that's a total investment of $1.5 million. The county wants the program to be sustainable after the initial pandemic relief funds are gone, Jacoby said. This will be accomplished by partnering with the business community and asking it to invest $150 per year per employee to sponsor child care solutions. Businesses also are able to make contributions directly to the fund through the Community Foundation of Johnson County. Better Together 2030 will serve as a liaison. We hope to continue to build that fund so within a few years it will be sustainable when the Federal American Rescue Act plan funds have been fully utilized, Jacoby said. Johnson County Social Services will work with providers to pay bonuses to new employees and to supplement wages of employees working within an approved center. 4Cs of Johnson County will work with the centers and in-home providers to educate them about the program. Johnson County's program is modeled after similar programs in Polk and Hamilton counties. Jacoby said the program in Hamilton County has been really successful, with businesses recognizing the value of investment in child care. In Hamilton County, a public-private partnership formed to create a retention and hiring bonus program for child care staff at 4 centers. The program was launched last year and is funded by contributions from businesses and local government. Jacoby said the outreach is just starting for Johnson County's program. Promotional materials are being developed, and the Iowa City Area Business Partnership has a website with information for the business community. It's going to be a process to roll this out, and we're prepared for that for the long haul, Jacoby said. Turning now to page 2, in the Iowa Today page, insurance agent from Cedar Rapids accused of forging checks. This story by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids insurance agent was accused this week of taking his client's insurance checks, forging them, and depositing the funds into his personal account. Joseph Drahozel, 57, of Cedar Rapids, is charged with 1 count of forgery and 2 counts of fraudulent sales practices, all felonies, and 1 count of third-degree theft, an aggravated misdemeanor. According to a criminal complaint, Drahozel was an insurance agent employed by DuPaco Credit Union from October 12, 2021 through April 15, 2022, when the incidents happened. On October 12, 2021, he's accused of using a check from one of his clients, forging it, and depositing the entire check of $1,917 into his personal account without authorization. An Iowa Insurance Division Fraud Bureau investigation also found he accepted $666 from one client and $146 from another client for insurance payment and misappropriated the funds by commingling them with his own funds, according to the complaint. Drahozel then made payments for premiums out of his account, but not until a late notice was received on or about April 6th. The insurance payment was missed April 5 due to the misappropriation, the complaint stated. If convicted, he faces up to 17 years in prison. Iowans with information about insurance fraud are encouraged to contact the Iowa Insurance Division's Fraud Bureau at 515-654-6556. And a judge dismisses a charge over a man's derogatory message to prosecutor. A judge ruled Wednesday that a Cedar Rapids man's derogatory message sent to a prosecutor, which was the basis for a harassment charge, was protected speech because she is a public official and it was directed to her job performance. The Facebook message sent by Marcus DeVore to Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter on December 22, 2021, focused mostly on her job performance. Sixth District Associate District Judge Casey Jones said in his ruling. Jones agreed with DeVore's argument on Monday that the message qualified as protected speech. A prosecutor is similar to a state trooper because they both deal with the public regarding enforcement of laws and must exercise a higher degree of restraint in the face of injurious or offensive language, according to the law cited by Eric Tindall, DeVore's lawyer, during a hearing on Monday. Tindall argued this was constitutionally protected political speech because it focused on job performance and doesn't contain a true threat or fighting words. Tindall said DeVore had a legitimate purpose in sending that message. It was a critique of Slaughter's work. DeVore made the comments in regard to Slaughter's actions or performance in the second-degree murder trial of his friend, Drew Blahnik, now known as Johnny Blahnik Church, who was convicted of killing Chris Bagley in 2018. A message, like a letter, can also be ignored and would allow the person reading the message time to cool down before confronting the sender, according to the ruling. This message to Slaughter was far less offensive than other messages the prosecution used for context leading up to the December 22 message. Jones dismissed the charge because the December 22 message, which he found as protected speech, didn't support the harassment charge. However, Jones did point out that he made no ruling on the uncharged messages sent December 11 and 12 because those contained some of the most vile words and sentiments in the English language. Also in Iowa Today News, Iowa City Schools not considering a four-day week in 2023-24. This story is by Grace King for the Gazette from Iowa City. Iowa City school calendars for the next 3 years, approved last month by the school board, don't include plans to move to a four-day school week, a conversation that had been initiated by district officials earlier this year. The school calendars have little to no changes from this current school year. The 2023-24 school year will begin August 23, and the last day is scheduled for June 5, 2024. Superintendent Matt Digner said that while the school board has not revisited the conversation of a four-day week, it had in March. Our responsibility is to keep an open mind and ask if we're doing the best we can with the current calendar, or is there a better solution out there? Calendars for 2024-25 and 25-26 were recognized by the board and subject to slight changes as the school years approach, Degner said. He said district officials are continuing to study the possibility of a four-day school week and would engage the community in conversations before moving forward. Degner said he wants to validate any concerns parents and community members might have about a four-day week, including childcare. Earlier this year, when Degner introduced the idea of a four-day school week to the board, he said it has the potential to create a better outcome for our students. Degner showed the board two calendar examples based on the 2024-25 school year. The first calendar accounted for every Friday being a no-school day. The first day of school would be August 12, and the last day would be June 27. The second possible calendar accounted for every other Friday being a no-school day. In this model, school would begin August 26th, and the last day would be June 27. For both calendars, the number of school days and staff work days would remain the same as it is now, Degner said. Continuing school through June also would give the district flexibility to include time off for more cultural holidays in the calendar. Winter break would continue to be 2 weeks, and additional mini breaks would be added throughout the year. Summer break would be most of July and the first week of August, which could lessen summer slide, the loss of achievement made during the school year, Degner said in March. Child care providers, he said, are optimistic they would be able to provide full daycare on no school days, Degner said at the time. The current school calendar, which begins after August 23 and ends around Memorial Day in May, is based on the old agricultural calendar, Degner said. It doesn't serve our students' best interests anymore. The state requires that schools begin no sooner than August 23, Degner said in his conversations with the Iowa Department of Education. The four-day school week is gaining some traction with the Cardinal Community School District in southeast Iowa, which moved to a four-day week for the current school year. In April 2021, the school board voted in favor of adding additional holidays to the school calendar, including the Muslim holy day of Eid al-Fitr and Jewish holy day Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur begins at sundown September 24, 2023, and Iowa City schools will not have school September 25, 2023, according to the school calendar. Eid al-Fitr begins at sundown April 9, 2024, and Iowa City schools will not have school April 10, 2024, according to the school calendar. Winter break is scheduled for December 25, 2023, to January 5, 2024. The school board began recognizing more holidays after a student advocated for it. Reem Kirja, who was an eighth grader at Northwest Junior High School at the time of the vote in 2021, created a petition on change.org to raise awareness and support for no school on Eid for Iowa City schools. The petition had received over 6,600 signatures. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Sunday's Washington Post titled, Long Wait for Trump Taxes. After a recent Supreme Court ruling, the House Ways and Means Committee at long last got former President Donald Trump's tax returns, nearly 1,400 days since the panel started asking for them. It was a proper reading of a law passed in 1924 that requires the Treasury Department to turn over any tax records that are requested by certain congressional committees for legitimate legislative purposes. The IRS also handed then-President Richard Nixon's tax records to the Joint Committee on Taxation amid the Watergate scandal in 1973, although an important difference was that Nixon himself had asked the committee to review them, famously asserting, "I am not a crook." Alas, the court's decision does not assure that Trump's tax records will ever become public, or that future presidents or presidential candidates will not follow his lead in refusing to voluntarily disclose their own. Restoring the norm under which presidential contenders voluntarily disclose their tax returns, followed by nearly every major party nominee since Nixon, is important. Voters should expect to know what financial conflicts of interest they might bring to the job. And in Trump's case, those records were especially relevant, given that he headed a sprawling and secretive, privately held business. In addition to his tax records, he should have provided a detailed accounting of his holdings and interests. His refusal to do so became glaring as Trump pressed to reform the tax code in 2017. Americans could only guess how its provisions might personally enrich the president and his family. If presidential candidates do not voluntarily share their returns, Congress might try to impose new rules. So could state lawmakers. In response to the Trump tax return saga, for example, New York legislators passed a law in 2019 allowing state officials to give congressional investigators the tax information they have on file. State lawmakers could also write laws that mandate the automatic release of candidates' state tax returns after they claim major party presidential nominations. But it should not come to that. It would be healthier for the country to see candidates once again perform essential acts of honesty and transparency, not because they have to, but because voters deserve it. 24-Hour Doorman today is titled, Did Lindmar Embrace Its Saviors? Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson each argued repeatedly during the midterm campaign that the Lindmar School District must be saved from the threat posed by its transgender support policies. But did voters in the district embrace their saviors? A mapping tool on the Linn County Elections website makes it possible to tell which general election precincts are fully or partially within the school district boundaries. Lindmar's boundaries include all or part of 11 Marion precincts, 5 Cedar Rapids precincts, 2 Marion Township precincts, and a small portion of Robbins. Within the school district, Democrat Liz Mathis received 53.2% of the vote to Hinson's 46.7, 11,097 to 9,733. Democratic candidate for governor, Deidre DeGeer, received 48.9% of the vote to Reynolds's 48.2, 10,203 to 10,041. Libertarian Rick Stewart received 584 votes. Lindmar is home turf for Hinson, who lives in the district and represented a chunk of this territory as an Iowa House member. Although the same can be said of Mathis, who also represented this area in the state Senate. But to be fair, both Hinson and Reynolds did better in the Lindmar district than they did countywide. Countywide, Hinson received 44.6% of the vote, Reynolds received 45.8%, but their biggest vote totals in the school district came in the Robbins precinct, which includes only a small portion of Lindmar's footprint. Votes from the entire Robbins precinct are included in my count. Hinson and Reynolds made the local controversy over Lindmar's transgender support policies a central theme of their campaigns, under the banner Parents' Rights. They met behind closed doors in Marion with select opponents of the policies, shutting out school officials and parents who support them. The governor and congresswoman assailed the school district repeatedly during the campaign. Quote, kids don't belong to government, kids belong to parents, end quote, was a common Hinson applause line. Did Lindmar voters have these issues on their minds as they cast ballots? It is, of course, impossible to tell what voters were thinking. Also, the candidates assailed Lindmar as part of a much broader effort to scare parents across the congressional district and state using manufactured fear of kids simply trying to feel safe and respected at school. Lindmar was just an example they could target to feed those fears. Here's my prediction with that. They've gone too far. I think they've gone too far even for the reasonable moderate Democrats. I think we're going to see a wave because of that, Republican Party Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman said loudly before the election. Iowa did get redder on election night, but that wave did not reach the school district that was the target of so much Republican derision. This offers little comfort. If State House Republicans want to target LGBTQ rights, there's nothing standing in their way. Next fall, 4 of 7 Lindmar School Board seats are on the ballot, and thousands of voters who weighed in on the midterms will skip the school board race. If it's Republicans bashing kids who have gone too far, the question is, how much farther will they go? And that's 24-Hour Doorman. One community letter today is titled, Citizens Police Academy Fosters Learning, Understanding. I am a recent proud graduate of Citizens Police Academy. The purpose of this program is to foster education and understanding of our dedicated police department. This is an ambassador program, and I highly encourage anyone of any age to check it out. Every class was so informative and interesting, we often stayed past the 3 hours because we did not want to quit. We learned and practiced self-defense and traffic stop procedures, explored the SWAT mobile and bomb unit, shot Glocks in simulated scenarios, and learned about polygraphs, canines, dispatch, and fingerprinting. We drove police SUVs at Hawkeye Downs and learned maneuvers. I even got to ride along on a 10-hour shift with an officer. The officers I was with during that late-night shift worked constantly and are highly skilled. Are you aware that the FBI does training with our men and women on the force? Some of our classmates are applying to go through the True Academy and intend to join the force. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell also took the course and learned, as we did, about funding, mental health needs, etc. There are 2 small classes a year, with the next one being in the spring. Give yourself the gift of learning more about our city's infrastructure and the integrity of our men and women in blue. Stay safe. And that's signed today by Maggie Locosa from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, December 1st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page, starting with the short notices. First from Cedar Rapids, Courtney Renee Bartlett, 33, died Tuesday, November 29, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Also in Cedar Rapids, Russell, known as Red Lee Kim, 87, died Monday, November 28, Rabbit Newhouse Funeral Service. In Decorah, Luke Hackman, 36, died Sunday, November 27, Helms Funeral Home. In Hiawatha, Jeanette K. Florschinger, age 58, died Saturday, November 26, Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in charge. In Kinross, Morris, known as Butch Toomer Jr., 74, died Tuesday, November 29th. Powell Funeral Home in Wellman is assisting the family. From Lansing, Karen A. Schultz-Leppert, 84, died Tuesday, November 29. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home. From North Liberty, Dan E. Christensen, 67, died Friday, November 25. Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Liberty. In Prairieburg, Tom Walker, age 90, died Tuesday, November 29. Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. In Van Horn, Karen Blanchard Court, 77, died Tuesday, November 29. Phillips Funeral Home, Keystone, is in charge. And from West Liberty, Kimberly K. Kreese, age 52, died Monday, November 28. Henderson Barker Funeral Home is assisting the family. Turning now to the regular notices, first, from North English, Martha, known as Mart Ruth Cohen. From North English, a Highland Ridge assisted living Williamsburg, Iowa resident for the past 5 years. Martha died on Monday, November 28th at Compass Memorial Hospital in Marengo at the age of 96. Visitation will be held Thursday, December 1st at 4 to 6 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. A private family service and burial will be held at a later date. Memorials may be given to the Millersburg First Responders, Foundation Fighting Blindness, or the Millersburg United Methodist Church. Powell Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Belle Plaine, Christopher Allen Allen, 61, passed away November 28th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life will be at 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, December 3, at the Belle Plaine Country Club. Private family burial will take place at a later date. Online condolences can be sent to the family at newhousefuneralservice.com. In Cedar Rapids, Jackie Bill Reese, 79, passed away on Tuesday, November 29, at his daughter's home, surrounded by his loving family. Services will be held Sunday, December 4, at 12 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Visitation will begin 2 hours prior to the service at 10. Burial will be in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Bagley, Wisconsin, Mary Ann Heil, age 89, passed away Wednesday, November 23, at home, watching the Wyalusing sunset, surrounded by her family. A memorial mass will be held Saturday, December 3 at 11 a.m. at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church in Prairie du Chien. Reverend Patrick Kelly officiating with interment in the church columbarium. Friends may call at the church on Saturday from 9 a.m. until the time of service. The Garrity Funeral Home of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family. From Blairstown, Miriam Canfield, age 102 and 6 months, passed away peacefully Monday, November 28 at Keystone Care Center. There will be no public service. There will be a memory plaque at Garden of Memories in Waterloo, Iowa. You can leave an online condolence at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. In Cedar Rapids, Edwin Oliver Olson, 94, passed away at his home Monday, November 28. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home Monday, December 5th from 2 p.m. until the service time at 3, with the certified celebrant Randy Walton officiating. Interment is to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of the Last Supper. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements, and you can leave a condolence at their website. In Manchester, Beverly Ann McQuillan, age 89, passed away Tuesday, November 29, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. The Mass for her will be live-streamed at blessedtrinitycluster.com. Online condolences can be sent to leonardmillerfuneralhome.com. Mass of Christian Burial is at 10:30 a.m., Saturday, December 3, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manchester, the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation is from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may also call from 9:30 to 10:15 at the church on Saturday. Interment will be at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Manchester. And lastly, from Iowa City, Mary Jo Klein, age 85. Mass of Christian Burial for Mary Jo will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Monday, December 5th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, with Father Gary Beckman officiating and Deacon Kabat assisting. She passed away Monday, November 28. Visitation will be Sunday, December 4, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Lensing Oak Hill Funeral Service, 210 Holiday Road in Coralville, where the rosary will be recited at 3:30. Burial will be at 2:30 p.m. Monday at Muscatine Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to St. Anne's Helpers of God's Helping Hands. You can leave a condolence at lansingfuneral.com. Moving now to the sports page, wrestling is in the sports page, and here's a girls' wrestling notebook story by K.J. Pilcher. Mid-Prairie girls' wrestling team has had a successful start. The Golden Hawks captured a tournament title the first weekend of the season. Now they can boast the program's first dual victory, three of them actually. Mid-Prairie topped Iowa City Liberty for its first official dual win, following with a come-from-behind barn burner against West Liberty and a dominant performance against Iowa City West to close the quadrangle at home. Plenty to celebrate with a 3-0 mark. We had never had a duel, Golden Hawks coach Dylan Walther said. We have faced some other teams and matched up according to approximate weight in the past. We have girls with experience. They are kind of spread apart in weights naturally. We have 10 girls on the team, and they managed to fill 10 weights without anybody bumping up or down too much. The Golden Hawks had little trouble in a 51-10 win over the Lightning, posting 7 pins. The duel with West Liberty, however, was a different story. The Comets soared to a 33-12 lead with 4 contested matches left. I was trying to figure out what to do with our lineup as the meet was going on and the rest of the night, Walther said. At one point, I was thinking about the next duel and did some math and thought, if we pin out, we have a shot. The wrestlers delivered. 3 pins and a forfeit were enough to claim a 36-33 win. The contributions came from athletes with various backgrounds. Marty Berry is new to the wrestling program, and she started it with a pin at 155 pounds. Mia Garvey, one of the more accomplished and veteran wrestlers, bumped a couple weight classes to get a pin at 190, and first-year wrestler Sam Stacy closed it with a first-period fall at 235. Mid Prairie closed the evening with a 54-6 win over West. Walther said the team has good depth and most can score points in big tournaments. I was expecting a pretty solid group, Walther said. Things changed a little bit with how the state tournament is set up this year. I don't know how that translates, but I would like to think we have a great shot at having a good showing toward the end of the year. Mid Prairie returns to BGM for competition on Friday and will wrestle at Williamsburg on Monday. The Dan Gable Donnybrook Wrestling Tournament is set to begin with girls wrestling competition Thursday at Extreme Arena in Coralville. The first sessions begin at noon and the second session at 5 p.m. 28 teams from 5 states are listed for the girls division. And Independence crowned 4 champions at the Central Invitational on Monday in Alcater. Morgan Crawl, Claire Carey, Havana Griffith, and Rachel Eddy all won titles. Eddy is the past IWCOA girls state champion and 2-time finalist. She is also ranked 21st nationally at 200 by USA Wrestling. And in boys wrestling, Prairie's Redding posts a pair of double dual wins. Logan Redding wanted something more. The Cedar Rapids Prairie senior wasn't satisfied with the finish of the last 2 seasons, so he's made a concerted effort to be his very best, attending more club workouts with his buddies and making every section of the Hawks' mental toughness training. I'm ready to make a difference, Redding said. I just really want to get down to the state tournament this year. It's kind of a big thing for me. Redding provided a boost to Prairie's double dual sweep Tuesday night at Clear Creek Havana and host Alburnett. He posted 2 pins to secure a 39-36 win over the Clippers and a 40-27 victory against the Pirates. Turning now to the hoopla section, On Their Toes is the title, and the front page includes characters from The Nutcracker. This story is by Diana Nolan. This time of year, baby ballerinas have visions of sugar plum fairies dancing through their heads. That's enough to keep them on their toes as they become mice, trees, and angels, working their way up to party guests, toy soldiers, flowers, snowflakes, sweets from around the world, and eventually the main roles of Clara, her Nutcracker prince, the Snow Queen, and the Sugar Plum Fairy and her cavalier. 2 major productions of the Nutcracker Holiday Classic are swirling into the corridor this weekend. The Nolte Academy is staging 5 performances Friday through Sunday at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. Ballet Quad Cities is joining Orchestra Iowa for 2 performances Saturday at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. The dancers then will return to their home stage at the Adler Theater in Davenport for 3 performances, December 10th and 11th. Orchestra Iowa will perform with them at the matinee and evening productions, December 10, and taped music will be used for the December 11 matinee. In brief, if you go, the Nutcracker will be performed by the Nolte Academy, December 2 to 4, 7:30 p.m. Friday, 1 and 7:30 p.m. Saturday, 1 and 6:30 p.m. Sunday. That takes place at the Englert Theater. Tickets are $20 to $42. Ballet Quad Cities and Orchestra Iowa, again, 2 o'clock and 7:30 p.m. performances at the Paramount Theater on Saturday, and those ticket prices are $18 to $49. And for details on the Adler Theater performances December 10 and 11 in Davenport, you can visit adlertheater.com/events. Exploring Regionalist View in Music in Cedar Rapids is the title of another article in the Hoopla section, and this is by Ed Condren, a correspondent. Susan Werner did her best Grant Wood impressions when she crafted her 2013 album, Hayseed. Wood, who's an iconic painter, who was a noted proponent of regionalism, is best known, of course, for the painting American Gothic. Wood, who grew up in Anamosa and Cedar Rapids at the turn of the 20th century and died in Iowa City, loved creating works capturing his home state. Werner accomplished the same with Hayseed, which reflects on her upbringing in a family farm. The collection commissioned by the University of Nebraska's Lead Center for the Performing Arts is a concept album about people and lifestyles in farm communities in rural areas. Hayseed's one of my favorite albums since so many people connect with it, Werner said by phone from her Chicago home. If you go, she will be performing, and this is an abbreviation of that article. She will be at the CSPS Hall at 1103 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids at 8 p.m. on Friday. Tickets are $25 in advance or $30 the day of the show. Her website is Susan Werner, that's WERNER.com. In the food category in the Hoopla section, breakfast and flights land at Checktown Station, this story by Elijah Desius. Nearly a year after it first opened in February, a Czech Village restaurant is under new ownership. On December 1st, Desiree Lorsung and Nate Gallagher, a couple who have been managing Cedar Rapids restaurants for more than 10 years, took their first official bite at ownership with Checktown Station. There, the couple who opened area restaurants like Grin and Goose, Bourbon Creek Smokehouse, and Pit Stop have poured decades of life experience into something of their own. After opening Checktown Station for the Nanke Group 10 months ago, with a hand in its early formation, they can officially call it theirs. It's just what we've always wanted. We finally found a home, said Lorsen, who first worked with Gallagher down the street at the Red Frog 11 years ago. With a robust all-day breakfast menu plus salads, sandwiches, and mouth-watering specials, Gallagher runs a back-of-house that's always working on new specials. As the couple see their vision come to fruition, more of those specials, such as Korean barbecue chicken sandwich, may appear as permanent menu items, thanks to customer feedback. Briefly, if you go, it's called Checktown Station. Its address is 69 16th Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Their hours are 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday to Thursday, 7 a.m. to midnight Friday and Saturday, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday. The phone number there is 319-200-5776. And they are a large all-day breakfast. They have a large all-day breakfast menu of Benedicts, waffles, skillets, and more, served alongside salads, sandwiches, specialties like goulash, and a full bar. They are available for dine-in or carry-out. Reconnecting with Iowa City is also a featured article in the Hoopla section. And this features Lisa Morris with Cat Clyde opening. She will appear at the Wildwood Smokehouse and Saloon in Iowa City, 7 p.m. Friday. Tickets are $25 to $100, and the artist's website is lissie.com. In another food-related category, Mamacita Taco Pub is moving to a new location. The former home of Vernon Bar and Grill didn't stay vacant for long before another growing restaurant decided to snatch up the space. Mamacita Taco Pub, which first opened at 834 First Avenue Northeast in March, will be moving to the larger location at 3025 Mount Vernon Road Southeast, less than a year after opening. In August, Vernon Bar and Grill left that location to move up the street with a new menu after 14 years in business. Mamacita's First Avenue location closed on November 26th, according to a social media post. Owners Haley Duncan and Ozzy Aguirre expect to open their new location by Christmas, when they'll have more space, booth seating, a bigger menu, and a new bar. Turning now to the Business 380, I'll abbreviate this article, but it is of interest and timely. Scammers are coming for you. Do you know who loves the holidays? Scammers. It's their favorite time of year because people are primed to spend money. Online shoppers are susceptible to fake shipping texts and emails, and the hunt for deep discounts to make their money stretch can make folks less suspicious. Online scams are particularly successful as more shoppers decide to skip the mall and simply click for their holiday gifts. I hate shopping, especially during the holidays. There's the hunt for a parking space, the throngs of customers in the long checkout lines at stores, with 10 lanes but only 3 cashiers. The old phrase, shop till you drop, becomes more like, shop till you want to scream. And despite fears of a recession and rising consumer prices, Americans intend to spend generously on holiday gifts in 2022, up the highest in 3 years, according to a recent Gallup poll. U.S. adults surveyed in October estimated they will spend an average of $932. A third of them plan to spend $1,000 or more. With online shopping presenting more opportunities for fraudsters, here are some tips to protect yourself. Look out for fake shipping text emails and messages. Don't click on anything in a text or email. Be a guest. Lots of online shopping sites want you to create an online account before you make a purchase. But to do so, you have to give up information to yet another database. Check out as a guest so you don't have to provide too much information. Don't be fooled by an offer or a gift card. Inflation has you worried about how far your money will go. But with email or text offering a $50 gift card, it's a fake. They all are. Seriously. Scammers love gift cards, too. If you're told to pay for an item with a gift card, you're about to be scammed, according to the Federal Trade Commission. Look for a physical address. Legitimate online stores should provide you with a physical address and working phone number in the contact section. Assume any holiday deal you received by text or mail is a fraud. Don't click on anything. Pay with a credit card, not a debit card. And unless you're willing to do some sleuth work, patronize known retailers. Your best defense is to be super paranoid about ensuring the season of giving doesn't turn into a season of taking from you. Finishing up with a look at the weather today, looking for a high of 41 in Cedar Rapids and a low of 30. Partly cloudy and windy pretty much the rest of the weekend, with those highs staying near the 40-degree mark, except Saturday, a high of just 29. The normal high for today is 39, the normal low is 22. A record high of 62 degrees was set in 1962, and a record low of 6 below zero was set in 1893. Sunset tonight is at 4:36 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 7:16 a.m., That gives us 9 hours and 21 minutes of daylight. We're in the first quarter of the moon phase, with moon rise at 1:32 p.m. and moon set at 1:23. Our temperatures will be up and down as we look at the 9-day forecast. It seems when we get our chilliest nights, we also have our clearest skies. In the morning, the only planet that remains visible this month is Mars. It will be in the western sky just opposite the sunrise, and that's by meteorologist Joe Winters. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, December 1st. I'm your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on the website iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thank you for listening, and have a great, safe day. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.